You found the number one internet site for irreverent, cool, and entertaining talk programming. It's LA Talk Radio. We say what we want.
You're listening to the Maria Sanchez Show on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning.
The Maria Sanchez Show. Current events, newsmakers, lifestyle, health, relationships, entertainment. Miss a day? Download the podcast at LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning. This is Maria Sanchez, and welcome to the Maria Sanchez Show. Thank you so much for joining us. We do appreciate your ears. We are live. It's Friday, July 19th. Happy Friday! I used to pick the children up from school on Fridays at 3 o'clock, and whoever was the first one in the van, it was, it's the weekend! And that was the beginning of our weekend. So fond, fond days of parenting. We've got some interesting parenting stories in the news today. Our guests this morning, we have Dr. Barton Goldsmith visiting with us. He claims there's no wrong side to get up in a shared bed. And he's a huge proponent about sleeping together with your mate. And no matter if you watch different TV shows or you have different hours or somebody snores, he says that sleeping and sharing the same bed has a lot of ramifications in the marriage. And then we have Kurt Waldron visiting with us. He was in Pamplona with the running of the bulls, which just ended on Sunday of this week. He's going to visit with us about his experience there. I've never been. I only heard of it for the first time when I was in college, when a boyfriend that I had run in the Pamplona running of the bulls. And it's the San Fermín Festival, and it's held every year from July 6th through the 14th. They say it goes back as far as the 14th century, the tradition, and then what it turned into today has been going on for many, 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 like hundreds of years. So we'll talk about that. We have some good news, which we always like. Totally Local VC held their dinner last night. They have three every year, and Kat Merrick, who's behind it, we've interviewed her on the program to promote it because forget whether or not you live in Southern California. Her whole thing is to buy local, eat local, do business local, because that makes for a better community, a stronger community, which makes for a stronger, you know, county, and then a stronger state and a stronger country. So love that message. So I volunteered to help out last night. I helped with registering folks when they came, and then I poured wine. It was a 5-course meal, and they have wine pairings, and they actually had beer that was brewed by Surf Brewery, and then Four Bricks wine was the wine that was being poured. It was a long table, 138 place settings, and the backstory to this is they had Tim Kilcoyne was the chef, and he was with the Sidecar restaurant, and I guess that rent situation changed, so he's no longer at that location. Anyway, this is a story about the insanity of humanity. So Tim had a boar or a hog or a pig, I don't know what it was, but it was a pig on a spit cooking. And this event last night was on the steps of City Hall. City Hall and the city of Ventura is celebrating its 100-year anniversary. So all kinds of great reasons to be there. And some of the employees in the City Hall government building complained because they're vegetarians and they didn't want to see an animal on a pit, you know, on a rotisserie, and they didn't want to smell what was coming. So what do you think happened? Not only were they heard, they had to move the pig to a remote location. So they moved it down the street to the mission, and Mission San Buenaventura, which Father Sarah was, I think that was the last mission that Father Sarah founded. And the grill that was there wasn't big enough to accommodate the pig, so they had to sever it up and throw it in the oven. So it didn't end up getting roasted the way it was supposed to because of a few squeaky wheels. So I guess that's kind of affirms what I always say about one voice, one vote, and one paycheck. So some of the good news is the Reagan Library had a blood drive that we helped promote on the program, and Jenny Mandel, who did the interview with us, just let me know that the Red Cross collected a total of 36 pints, many of them first-time blood donors. So she said thank you, and we say thank you for going out and helping to make a difference. And no matter where you are in this world, if you can give blood, please do so, because you're actually paying it forward, and you never know what life you're going to save. So we mentioned yesterday that the Rolling Stone cover story with Jahar Tsarnaev is hitting the newsstands today, and how Boston was just indignant over it, and that five major retailers had promised that they would not be selling this month's issue. Well, there's more news that has unfolded, because photographs that were taken by a Massachusetts state police sergeant, his name being Sean Murphy, he is a police tactical photographer, he released them to Boston Magazine because he said that the cover of the Rolling Stone glamorized the face of terror, and he wanted people to see Jahar Tsarnaev as he really is slash was when he got apprehended. So the photos are online. More of them are going to be released in the September issue of the Boston Magazine, and they're quite chilling. If you get a chance, you can see them. But what happened is Boston Magazine says that later yesterday that Sergeant Sean Murphy had been relieved of his duty hours after releasing the photographs, and the status of the sergeant's duty would be reviewed next week. Massachusetts State Police declined to comment on whether Murphy had been suspended. But then there was a statement released from the state police saying that Sergeant Murphy has been relieved of his duty for one day and is the subject of an internal investigation. John Wolfson, the editor of Boston Magazine, said Sergeant Murphy has also been ordered not to talk to media or anyone else about the events that took place in Watertown on April 19th. Wolfson said that Sergeant Murphy's gun, badge, and computer were taken from him. So the photos show that were taken by Sergeant Murphy show that Jahar Tsarnaev emerging from the boat in the backyard of the Watertown home. He's bloody. He's slumping. There's a red laser dot of an officer's weapon on the forehead. And here is Sergeant Murphy's statement. As a professional law enforcement officer of 25 years, I believe that the image that was portrayed by Rolling Stone magazine was an insult to any person who has ever worn a uniform of any color or any police organization or military branch, and the family members who have ever lost a loved one serving in the line of duty. The truth is that glamorizing the face of terror is not just insulting to the family members of those killed in the line of duty. It also could be an incentive to those who may be unstable to do something to get their face on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. I hope that the people who see these images will know that this was real. It was as real as it gets. This may have played out as a television show, but this was not a television show. Officer Dick Donahue almost gave his life. Officer Sean Collier did give his life. These were real people with real lives, with real families. And to have this cover dropped into Boston was hurtful to their memories and their families. I know from firsthand conversations that this Rolling Stone cover has kept many of them up again. It's irritated the wounds that will never heal again. There is nothing glamorous in bringing more pain to a grieving family. Photography is very simple. It's very basic. It brings us back to the cave. An image like this on the cover of Rolling Stone, we see it instantly as being wrong. What Rolling Stone did was wrong. This guy is evil. This is the real Boston bomber, not someone fluffed and buffed for the cover of Rolling Stone magazine. So that's the more of the controversy that's going on today. I also saw a story that says that the magazine is already selling for $20 on eBay. So we have good news in the news that Moody's has raised its outlook on the United States debt to stable, dropping the negative outlook that it's maintained for nearly 2 years. Moody's Investors Service has also affirmed its top rating, AAA, for the United States government, noting that the nation's debt trajectory is on track to meet the criteria laid out in August 2011 for return to a stable outlook. Woohoo! Okay, so you know how they call the like the 40s and the 50s people, folks, boomers, the helicopter parents, because they hover and they won't let their kids out and they won't let them explore and they won't let them do. And I'll never forget when my three sons rode their bicycles to the grade school for the first time. I got a call from the principal and she's like, Maria, yes, your sons rode their bikes to school today. I know. She said, you know, they have to cross busy streets. I said, I know. I taught them how to do that. There's signal lights. There's traffic, you know, cross guards. And she's like, out of the five bikes in the school, three of them are yours. I said, I know. And you also have bike racks there. I'm not quite sure what's the problem. So that's, you know, when my kids were in grade school, now they're in their 20s. So in New York, mom and dad are hiring at $400 an hour people called recreation experts to help organize play dates for their children because some of the kids need to learn how to play. This is according to the CEO of one of the firms that organizes these play dates. So what she does is she involves groups of 3 to 5 4-year-olds in a room, and then they monitor how the kids share crayons and how they draw and how they follow directions and how they hold a pencil. Because she says their lives have become so regimented with classes and subjects like Mandarin and violin that they don't know how to play with others. Is that pathetic? So following on that, a girlfriend of mine shared, there's a new parenting trend. She's got three little ones. They're 6 and under. It's called CTFD. And they said, you know, there's all kinds of trends. One is attachment parenting. One is minimalist parenting. There's the tiger mother parenting. So this new technique is called CTFD. It stands for calm the fuck down. And that's not the message for the kids. It's for the parents. Using CTFD will help you understand that your child will be fine whichever way you choose to parent as long as you don't abuse them. So here are potential parenting ceremonies, and then we'll get to our first guest, how CTFD can be employed. Are you worried your friend's child has mastered the alphabet quicker than your child? CTFD, calm the fuck down. Are you scared you're not imparting the wisdom your child will need to survive in school and beyond? Calm the fuck down. Concerned that you're not the type of parent you thought you'd be? Calm the fuck down. Upset that your child doesn't show interest in certain areas of learning? CTFD. Stressed that your child exhibits behavior in public you find embarrassing? CTFD. By using the CTFD method, they're assured that the pressure is lifted, that you as a parent realize your child loves you no matter what, even if they've yet to master the alphabet. As a parent, you also realize that you may not be the best parent in the world, but as long as you love your child, they'll think you are, and that's what matters. So here's how you use CTFD. Here's the simple steps. Calm the fuck down. Number two, there is no second step. So ignore all those other parenting trends and stick to CTFD. You'll be glad you did, and so will your kid. So now we're going to speak with Dr. Barton Goldsmith about the shared bed with your mate and how important that is for the relationship and intimacy. He's a nationally syndicated columnist. He is also a radio talk show host. He's a blogger for Psychology Today, a regular contributor to Cosmopolitan magazine, and winner of many awards.
The Maria Sanchez Show, a conversation, not a confrontation, on LA Talk Radio and MariaSanchezShow.com.
Good morning, Dr. Goldsmith. This is Maria Sanchez. You're live and on the program. Thank you so much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Just explain to our listeners all the various things that you do and have achieved, including Hall of Fame awards, and you're a busy man, not to mention with your practice. But I read the article that you wrote about the sharing of the bed, and I thought that that's something that's important for folks to understand, because I've been told I'm single, so I'm divorced. I've been told on many occasions, mostly by women, the secret to a successful marriage is separate bedrooms.
Separate bathrooms, yes. Separate bedrooms, no.
Uh-huh. So share with us why you feel that.
Well, obviously, when you're with someone, you know, and you're close, if you're not sharing a bedroom, it usually starts out in not a good way. I mean, if someone's ill, I understand that. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the time, couples get into arguments. And one will sleep downstairs or in another room or with a kid or something like that. And it starts out seemingly like, I'm just mad at you for the night. And then it continues. And people end up with separate bedrooms. And what that does is erode away at the foundation of the marriage. And then it becomes snipey. And you feel like your partner doesn't like you. And what are you doing with someone who doesn't like you? And it gets deeper and the resentment builds. Until you either see a marriage counselor or you see a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds fairly simple, but I know a lot of people, especially in this day and age with dual career households, you know, different hours, different constraints, workaholics, that you can't always make the time. So you're suggesting that you should probably make it a priority to make it happen.
Oh, you have to make it a priority, and you have to make your relationship a priority. When you put your relationship first, then the rest of your life falls into place. And I know there are a lot of people who would disagree with that, and that's fine. But my experience has shown me that families and couples who put their relationship first have better relationships, better families, healthier, less, you know, abuse, all of it. It's a very positive thing.
And then in terms go ahead.
Well, what I was going to say, I think that what a lot of people don't understand is that when you sleep with someone, you exchange energy, consciousness, you exchange a different kind of connectivity that doesn't happen when you're having sex. I mean, it's much more powerful than that because you're spending a whole night in that space with someone, you do get connected. And night after night after night, you do get connected. When you talk with widows or widowers, they don't talk about missing the sex, you know, or the activities with their partner. They talk about the companionship.
Mm-hmm.
Just being with that person, being close to that person.
And knowing that they're there, reaching out and touching or, you know, connecting even subliminally or whatever. I have an example of this. My folks have been married 58 years, and I was visiting with them last week, taking care of them. And my dad's recovering from an injury, so he's in a hospital bed in their bedroom. And he's not sleeping that well, so consequently, my mother isn't either, because as he lifts up the bed, she hears it, she wakes up, you know, that kind of thing. So the caregiver said to me, we have an overnight caregiver that we can provide so that your mother can go and get a good night's sleep, and then your father doesn't have to worry about disturbing her if he needs some help throughout the night. So I thought, wow, what a great idea. And they have the finances. That's not an issue about that. And my mother said, no, this is my bedroom, and this is my bed, and this is where I will sleep. She had no intention. There was no way that somebody was going to go into her room and not be her.
And, you know, it makes sense. To me, it makes sense. And, you know, she's protecting her space. This is where she gets revived.
Right.
This is, you know, this is her sacred space.
But what about people who have either insomnia or they have sleep apnea or they snore or those kinds of issues that would prevent another person from getting a good night's sleep?
You know, you have to be mindful and respectful of what's going on with you so that you don't disturb your partner. My partner happens to be an insomniac. She will wake up at all hours and be up. But she, you know, gets up quietly, leaves the room, goes into another room and reads or does whatever. And you just have to, if that's the case, you're respectful of the person that you're with.
Yeah, because I was
and
married
to... You try to make those kinds of considerate moves, you know.
Accommodations.
Yeah, I'm apparently sleep. I'm a flailer. My arms go all over the place, and both she and the dog, you know, tend to be at the other end of the bed. and okay, I mean, I understand that, but that's not going to. That's certainly, and she understands it, but certainly not going to keep us from sleeping together.
Because I was married to an insomniac, and he refused to get out of bed, so he would stay in bed, and he would just flip. And back and forth and back and forth and back and forth and sigh and moan and groan. And I was like, F and A, man, I can sleep, but not with you doing that. So sometimes I would just get out of the bed and lay on the floor because I didn't want to leave the room, but I also didn't want to be jolted every time he was rolling around.
Oh, I understand. I understand. And it can be very difficult. But again, you know, you have to work it through. You have to talk out what's the best thing for both of you. How can we do this in a considerate manner?
Mm-hmm. So, Dr. Goldsmith, when people come to you with their issues, do you start with something simple like this, like saying, do you sleep in the same bed together, and then make that an assignment? Or how do you break down problems?
Well, certainly if in, you know, my initial interview, I find out that they're not sleeping in the same bed together, one of the things I do initially is get them back into the marriage bed. I think that's very important. What do we need to do to make that okay? You know, and sometimes that has been get treatment for sleep apnea, and sometimes that has been a heartfelt apology, and sometimes, you know, they start out in, and this is actually a great way to do it. If you haven't slept together in the same bed for a while, go to a hotel for one night. Take a one-night vacation, you know, and have a romantic night in a hotel. And then when you come back, the bedroom is then again your romantic hideaway, which is what it should be. You want to make your bedroom your romantic hideaway.
And I think, I guess the problem is that people think that the bed might suggest that there's sex. And I suppose there's a difference between sex and intimacy, or sex and snuggly.
Oh, a huge difference. I've written an entire book on intimacy with one chapter on sex.
Ah.
Intimacy has got a lot more going on. And it's that closeness that you feel that I was describing earlier with the one that you love that makes it so much easier.
So you've been in practice for over 20 years, correct?
Yes, yes.
What have been the changes in the dynamics of relationships, in your estimation, in the time that you've been practicing?
Wow, we could certainly write a book about that.
Uh-huh, I would imagine.
You know, I mean, in the time that I've been practicing, more relationships are equal. The roles around the house are negotiated equally. Women are taking as much responsibility for breadwinning as men are. Men are taking more responsibility as much as women are for child rearing and, you know, making sure that the house is together. I live in a place called West Lake Village, which I know you're familiar with. And I was out on a boat at the docks, just kind of hanging out on a summer's night. And there were three, four guys talking on the dock. And you'd think that they would be talking about football or sports or business or whatever. They were all talking about their kids and what schools and what teachers they were picking. I mean, it was amazing. I was eavesdropping, obviously, but I thought, you know, these guys, they're sitting there talking about the best way to raise their kids. Mm-hmm. Things have changed. Men are very involved. I know I'm very involved with our kids. And, you know, it's changed to a much more of a team, much more of a partnership. And I think that's a great dynamic.
Now, are you but people come to you in general when they're in crisis, right? And needing triage.
Generally when they're in crisis, yeah. I mean, not too many people come in and say our relationship is doing perfect. We just wanted you to, you know, reiterate that for us.
Yeah.
But they usually come in when there's difficulty, yeah, of course.
And so do you see that this dual income pressure is better for a relationship because it's more egalitarian, whereas before it used to be the woman would maybe be more subservient because she knew she wasn't bringing in the bacon, and so his opinion mattered more, or she needed to defer to him, you know, more to...
I think modern marriages are healthier and stronger than the old ones in many cases, because the most important factor, and when I'm not really, the egalitarian thing is great, but we're communicating on the same level now. People aren't feeling, or certainly should not feel, subservient to another person. There's got to be, you know, it's got to be equal. You've got to respect one another in that manner. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to have the kind of depth and intimacy that you want. You can't be intimate with somebody you don't respect. And
I
go ahead.
What I find is interesting is the if you don't cohabitate, regardless of marriage, that you have an opportunity then to not really be intimate, because if something goes awry, you have the ability to leave.
Oh, which, absolutely. Yeah, you have that escape hatch.
Right, which can lead to things getting unresolved or actually be undone because you're out of there instead of being forced to be in there, making it work somehow.
Yeah, exactly. And leaving is a final, leaving is the last option. You don't want to do that. You don't want to leave your relationship. You don't want to threaten your relationship. You want to make it as pleasant a place as possible for both of you. And it's, go ahead.
One thing that I've noticed, though, the difference between men and women that you were talking about, because the guys will say, I can't because I got to babysit. And I always say to them, you mean parent? Because a babysitter is of someone who comes from the outside, not a parent.
Right. No, I think that's a good, I think that's a good distinction.
So as evolved as we may have become, but I see my brother who had children later in life. The parent that he is, he's in his 50s and he's got a first grader and a pre-K. Unbelievable what he does with them and in support of and takes them. And I mean, it recreates with them independently of his wife and everything else.
Mm-hmm,
it's like,
mm-hmm.
Wow, that's a partner.
It changes as you mature. You become less self-absorbed. You become less narcissistic. Mm-hmm. And it becomes about the people that you love. That's what's supposed to happen. That's how we're supposed to grow.
So do you give steps then also? Like, do you say the obvious? Like, obviously, you guys, if you're in separate rooms, you're not going to be able to be intimate, and we're not just talking sex. And I mean, are you able to be that forthcoming, or is the way you practice?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I have couples come in, they're not doing really well. I may start them off doing, you know, different things. Every couple, every case is different. You don't learn therapy or do therapy from a book. But I do, you know, I've written several and I use them as part of how I get my couples back together again.
And
for example, I will say, take one of my relationship books or any relationship book, and I will say, read a chapter in this book out loud to one another and talk about it. Take 10 minutes out of your week and talk about this particular aspect of a relationship. How to tell your partner that something that they do bugs you? How do you say that in a way that's not going to offend them?
How do you?
And discuss it. You know.
How do you? You make eye statements.
You know, yeah,
right?
always start out with a term of endearment, honey.
Okay.
You know, I love you, and I love sleeping with you. And I wonder if she can hear me. And I enjoy our life together. But when you eat chips in the middle of the night.
I had a therapist once that said, when you hear the word but, that means everything following that is the truth.
Or it's not an apology.
Uh-huh.
You know, I mean, and yeah, I mean, people, but the truth is also, honey, I love you. I enjoy our life together. You just do this one little thing that bugs me, and do you mind altering it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I got mad and name called and said, how could you, and you're so inconsiderate and blah, 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 that's not going to make for a good relationship. She's not going to feel good. I'm not going to feel good. And the issue is certainly not going to get resolved.
And then when does accepting people for who they are and loving them in that failed way come in, as opposed to what bugs you about them?
You know, acceptance is a huge, huge part of relationships. And it's a very, you know, when couples accept themselves in their relationships as a place of not just comfort, but also as a platform for growth, it makes moving forward much more doable. It allows your love to grow, and as you accept each other's changes with the passing of time, it grows closer. It actually may be the key to a happy relationship. And think about acceptance in another way, too. If you give in on the little things, usually the big ones go your way, right?
But
being stubborn makes life more difficult.
But if that's if the person knows, don't they have to have an awareness that you're acquiescing or you're compromising instead of, in other words, I see people who, couples, you know, and I'm looking for them afar. I kind of idolize couples that are successful because I haven't been thus far. And I see them with their proclivities and their quirks and whatever. And sometimes the partner gets a kick out of it. And it's like, yep, she can never find this, or he's always getting lost, or, you know, whatever, which might drive somebody crazy. And the other one is going, yep, that's who they are. Oh, well, you know, we have GPS now. It's not as much of a problem. Instead of, how come you're always lost? Why can't we get the directions before we leave the house, or those sorts of things?
You know, I mean, again, you do accept that takes, in our relationship, for whatever reason, takes me longer to get out of the house than it does her.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and she goes in the car and listens to music, cranks it up, you know, you know, again, it's just the way it is. I have to make sure that all the doors are locked and the animals are in and everybody's okay.
Mm-hmm. And so rather than her fuming and stewing that you're always, I don't know if you're late, but you're take forever, because my dad did that too. My mother used to call him Marilyn, as in Monroe, because she was notoriously mm-hmm. late. So she accepts you for who you are, and that's what you are, and so she makes the best of it.
Yeah, I think that the idea is you don't want to, by the way, you don't want to necessarily have to make the best of things. You want to make them as good as possible.
So how do you that's do that you, if you have different clocks or different...
You know, there's a chapter in my book, Emotional Fitness for Intimacy, that says, are you the cat or the bunny in your relationship? Meaning, are you the snoozer or are you the energizer bunny? Mm-hmm. You know, and there are night owls and morning larks that get together. Opposites mm-hmm. don't necessarily make for a difficult relationship, and there are some people that believe that they make for stronger relationships. You know, one of the living theorists of our day, Harville Hendricks, creator of Imago Therapy, thinks that differences are the foundation for making a relationship grow closer. Hmm. And I agree with him. I think that those differences make for more interest, and they make for not only a greater sense of connectedness when you know, are enjoying doing the different things together, but they make your life more stimulating. Mm-hmm. If someone agrees with you all the time, it's going to get kind of boring.
I would think so. I would.
You know, so you want someone to bring new and different things into your world.
Well, I know your website is bartongoldsmith.com, amongst mm-hmm. others, and we're going to put your contact information up when we post the podcast. Thank you for your time. I love your point of view.
Well, thank you very much. Call anytime.
Okay, Dr. Barton Goldsmith, appreciate it.
Take
and
care.
You too. And have a great weekend. And so what we do every morning, we're live at latalkradio.com, channel 2, and then we're available for download later in the day and on iTunes and Stitcher. And we always put our guest contact information so you can just click and go, and we hyperlink to that too. And before we get to our next guest, speaking of relationships, this is out of UCLA. It's in the news today. A study suggests that the so-called sexual addiction isn't a real disorder. It apparently affects about, reportedly, 16 million Americans, including a number of well-known celebrities, Tiger Woods, Russell Brand, David Duchovny. And Tiger's in the news this morning because apparently his ex-wife approves of his relationship with Lindsey Vonn, just in case you needed to know. So in the study, UCLA scientist Nicole Prowse monitored the brain activity of 39 men and 13 women, all with sexual image issues, while they were shown various erotic images. And she says, if you think sexual problems are an addiction, we would have expected to see an enhanced response to those sexual images. If you think it's a problem with impulsivity, we would have expected to see decreased responses to those sexual images. The fact that we didn't see any of those relationships suggests that there's not great support for looking at these sexual behaviors as an addiction. So she says she doesn't want to discourage people from seeking help, but believes treatment options other than sex rehab should be examined. And in the meantime, the American Psychiatric Association excluded sex addiction as a condition in its newly released updated guide. there was not sufficient evidence at this time to include sexual addiction, not only in the DSM, which stands for Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders itself, but even in the index for further study. So there's high skepticism. So you can't use that as an excuse anymore, people. Okay, so if you're in the United States, all but one state, Alaska, reached 90 degrees or more yesterday. And because of that, they're saying the tempers are flaring, and we now have something that has been identified as heat rage. And they're saying it's not new. Of course, there's road rage, air rage, fan rage at sporting events, heat rage. So when we're uncomfortable for any reason, we tend to perceive things in a more negative way. People have frayed nerves and shortened tempers. And in some parts of the country, temperatures didn't drop below 80 degrees at night. And New York City had a 79 and 80 degree low so that they can't even get a chance to recover before they start the next day. So you're supposed to stay in air conditioning, drink plenty of water, and avoid situations that generally irritate you and these types of situations that might make you blow your cool. Heat, by the way, also increases testosterone production, which can increase aggression. So keep your cool and just know that this too shall pass. So now we're going to speak with Kurt Waldron. He has been just returned from Pamplona, Spain, and we're going to talk with him about what that was like and his firsthand view of that all. We're going to dial him down. Hi, Kurt. It's Maria Sanchez. Good morning. You're on the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. How are you?
I'm excellent. The world traveler that you are, president and CFO of Vapor here in Southern California, and having attended the running of the bulls in Pamplona, Spain with your daughter. Is that correct?
Correct.
And the occasion was she had graduated.
It was a college graduation gift, exactly. We do, as a family, love to travel. We have been fortunate enough to travel in a lot of different places, and she definitely has the travel bug. So I said, as a gift, you can go anywhere in the world that mom does not want to go. And that's where she picked.
How fun. Now, has she had a fascination with this before, or do you know how it came onto her radar? Because not everybody even knows about it, let alone wants to attend.
Well, needless to say, I think when you're 21 years old, I think that part of the attraction is, where's the party? And we certainly, I think, we're at ground zero for that.
So explain to us, tell us what it was like. Where did you stay and how did you participate and what did you see and what are your thoughts? Because this year had 50 people sent to the hospital. I think that was an all-time high.
It's a 9-day festival. People don't typically realize it's a 9-day festival that honors Saint Fermin, who was a saint who was born in Pamplona. And the festival itself has been going on since the 15th century, but the bull running had started probably 200 years ago, and it was started really to move the bulls from an off-site corral into the bull ring. But of course, somewhere along the line, the Spaniards decided to make it a party, and that it is. It is 24/7 nonstop. You're really subject to a lot of self-discipline there because, quite frankly, you could be served alcohol at any time of the morning, day, or night. With that being said, 3 days is probably the limit that you want to spend there, just from a pacing standpoint and being able to just survive it. But we stayed about a mile outside of the festival itself, which I think is a great way of doing it, just because we were able to get some quiet and peace at our hotel, because anywhere within the confines of the festival itself, it is just incredibly loud and it's nonstop. I mean, whether it's 1 a.m. or 6 a.m, it is very, very loud. And, you know, decadent, I guess, for lack of a better word.
Now, have you been to, say, Mardi Gras, New Orleans?
I have. I've been to Mardi Gras twice, and people have asked me to compare the two, and I'd say this is Mardi Gras on steroids. I would say that the liability concerns that may exist in the United States don't necessarily exist in Spain, as well as the fact that the alcohol serving is just nonstop. And then, of course, you know, for added entertainment, you throw in six 1,500-pound bulls at 8 in the morning every morning, and that certainly puts a different wrinkle into the whole thing.
Well, when I was doing some of my research, it said among the rules to take part in the event are that participants must be at least 18 years old, run in the same direction as the bulls, not incite the bulls, and not be under the influence of alcohol.
I would say that those are certainly at a minimum should be the rules. and they do, you know, to their credit, they sweep the street at 7. The street is very narrow. It is actually reminded me a lot of Bourbon Street. It's a narrow cobblestone street. It's about a half mile in length. It has a couple of turns to it. But they do clean the street, sweep the street, clear it completely at 7 in the morning, and then basically let people get back onto the street at around 7:15 before they release the bulls at 8.
And then they say, were you actually there when the bulls were running on some days?
Oh, absolutely. I was, we were there for three of the 9 days. We witnessed from a balcony, we witnessed the bulls come by twice. And then one of those days we were out on the street with the bulls. And, you know, there's a misconception that a lot of people have. Certainly I've learned since I've gotten back that they think that we all take off with the bulls at the start gate. And that's not the way it works. In fact, the bulls start off all by themselves. A rocket gets sent off that announces basically to the city that think of it as a firework. A pretty loud noise you hear anywhere in the city that you know that the bulls have now been released. And within about 30 yards, they meet up with the first set of runners or humans that are on the street. And then they proceed to run, down the cobblestone street. And, you can't outrun the bull. That I guarantee you. The bulls are running faster than anybody on the street is running. And so you will be passed by the bulls at some point. So it's up to you as to where you start along the stretch of road. We started probably 500 yards from the bull ring. So probably with one third of the street of the path left to go. And that was strategic. That was our decision to do that because we wanted to be able to make it into the bull ring because they close the bull ring right after the bulls get in.
So, but if you precede the bulls in the bull ring, then are you not vulnerable in the ring as well?
Yeah, we did not precede them. They passed us. So we waited until the bulls got within about 10 yards of us, and then we proceeded to start running. And then the bulls passed us probably with about 200 yards left to go into the bull ring. And then we followed in right behind them. I may add, by the way, that being concerned about the bulls is probably half the challenge. The other half is literally the human stampede.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of people, and they're all trying to do one thing, which is stay away from those bulls. And it is extremely hectic. I was separated, and I knew this going in, that there was a strong likelihood this would occur, but I was separated from my daughter probably within 10 yards of when we started. I didn't see her again until we got into the bull ring.
Just because of the density of the experience.
Yeah, and it's quite hectic. You know, if somebody unfortunately trips and falls down, and that's occurring quite a bit, it is extremely difficult for that person to get back up again. And at that point, they suggest that you curl up in the fetal position and just hang low, because people will be stepping on you and stepping over you, and it's just very, very hectic.
And I heard that on Saturday, that's exactly what happened, and that's why 23 people were taken to the hospital, because there was a pileup.
Yeah, I certainly, you know, having done it and been there, and I knew this before I got there, I mean, this whole thing is, not the smartest thing to be doing. I mean, these are wild animals. They're quite... they're quite perturbed, and they've got a lot of angst coming down that road.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, a lot of people have asked me, oh, you know, how close did you get? And I said, well, close enough I could hear them breathing, and that's good enough for me. But yes, going into the bullring is very, very hectic because the road narrows. It narrows into a tunnel that goes into the bullring. And that was our concern when we were there on Wednesday, was we need to get through that tunnel because that just looks like a very ugly piece of path. And sure enough, that's exactly what I understand happened on Saturday, with a couple people tripped in that tunnel. And then you had a big pile up of people, and unfortunately the bulls were still coming.
So you started out ahead of them, and they say they run about 15 miles an hour, which is why they pass most people. And they did pass you, the bulls?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
They you know, we waited. We kind of had our little strategy. We had watched it the day before. We waited for them to get about within 10 yards of us. And then we simply took off running with everybody else. I mean, even if you didn't want to run, the human stampede would probably push you along. But we took off, and they passed us, I'd say, within a couple hundred yards of the bull ring. And then we just kept on running because we wanted to get in the bull ring. It's quite the scene when you come into the bull ring, because there's 20,000 people sitting in their seats kind of cheering you on as if you've just completed a marathon or what have you. Quite a surreal moment. And then the bulls are guided right through the bull ring and out the other end into corrals. And then another rocket is released to basically announce to everybody that the bulls are put away.
And then, of course, they're there to be fought in a bullfight.
Yes, yes. We did attend the bullfight that afternoon, and I guess I wasn't sure what to expect, and I got to try to be respectful of people's cultures, but I would describe the bullfight as just nothing short of barbaric. It was tough. It was very difficult. My daughter was pretty upset. I don't think she kind of knew what to expect. But you know, I'm stating the obvious, and the bull obviously never has a chance. It's the same six bulls that run in the morning are presented for the bullfight in the evening. The one saving grace is that for a literally half of the 20,000 people in the stands are not really even watching the bullfight. We have all brought in, and we were foretold this beforehand, we all brought in as much sangria as we could humanly carry in Boda bags, trash cans. It was unbelievable. I brought a Boda bag full of sangria, and I was absolutely undermanned. I mean, there were people walking in with small trash cans where two men had to carry it in, full of sangria.
But they, of course, weren't running. You were running, so you couldn't.
This was in the evening. Now at 6 o'clock in the evening, and the sangria is used to pour on each other's heads and to dance and as my daughter said later, I think we all do that to avoid the distraction of what's going on in the bull ring. Because after really the first bullfight, no one's watching what's going on in the bull ring. They're all just pouring sangria on each other's heads. And we were told beforehand to expect it and to leave all valuables at home. And if we had to take something, we were provided plastic bags to wrap it in, because when I say we were dumped on, I'm describing head to toe being dumped on with sangria.
Interesting. When they're watching the bullfight, are they wearing the white pants and the white shirts and the?
The minute you pretty much enter the city limits of Pamplona, you are wearing white with the red scarf. And quite frankly, I would say that if you are not, you are very noticeable. And I would say that 98 to 99% of the people anywhere in that city during the festival, whether it's a 6-month-old infant in a baby stroller to a 90-year-old man walking down the street, is wearing white with a red scarf.
So that white with red sangria makes for nice stains, I would imagine.
Yes, it was left in the trash in Spain before we left. There was no sense bringing it back. So.
And quickly, Kurt, I believe it or not, my mom's Spanish and Basque, actually. So I was raised going to bullfights as a child. And I don't know if they still do it, but the matadors, if they perform particularly eloquently, they were given trophies from the bull, like ears, and the ultimate trophy was the tail. Do they do that still?
I can't say that I saw any of that. I will say that my impressions of the matadors were, pretty arrogant guys. I mean,
yes.
I think in Spain they get treated like rock stars, and
they
would say that they acted like it when they walked out into the ring. They're very demonstrative in everything they did, whether mm-hmm. it was throwing their hats or doing whatever. They definitely liked playing up to the crowd.
Uh-huh.
And, I got to give them credit. Anybody who's standing toe-to-toe with a 1,500-pound animal who's fighting for his life, I got to say there's certainly some danger to that. But
absolutely. But, yes, they are revered, and they're trained from an early age. They're sent to academies, and they are royalty almost, if you will. And, of course, they've got to have huge egos because they're, like you said, they're really not a match, although it is skewed like Las Vegas to their advantage without what is and isn't acceptable. With the performer.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I walk away from the entire festival having a whole new appreciation for the Spaniards' ability to party, because it was quite a tumultuous 3 days.
Well, Kurt, thank you so much for your time. You've explained it brilliantly, and thank you for letting us into the world of Pamplona, Spain, and the running of the bulls.
Oh, no worries. Great,
take care.
Great to be on and talk to you. Bye-bye.
You too. Bye-bye. Kurt Waldron. So, again, slice of life. This is Maria Sanchez. Have a fabulous day, a tremendous weekend. We look forward to visiting with you on Monday morning.